Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your favorite podcast. This is realestateinvestormba.com. We created Real Estate Investor MBA to leverage the knowledge of giants through synthesizing and providing much needed information to all investors, from the veteran investor to the new and aspiring investor. At Real Estate Investor MBA, we plan to cover pertinent information head on with our expert guests, who we will interview on what they are doing and preparing for in the days and years ahead. We aim to create MBA quality curriculum topics and themes from the information garnered among our interviewed guests in order to bring world-class value to our fellow community of listeners. We truly believe that rising water raises all ships. And by sharing this leveraged knowledge, we can create a stronger online community, which translates to stronger local, regional, and national communities. Your hosts are Jeremy Moyer, who is a veteran real estate investor and author of a new book called Are You Playing the Real Estate Game Blind? As well as Tejas Gosai, the owner of eXp Realty, the Tejas Gosai team, and also co-manager in a newly formed Regulation D private equity fund called the Lehigh Valley Private Equity Fund. Now let's get to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to your favorite real estate podcast. This is Real Estate Investor MBA. I'm Tejas Gosai, and this is my host, Jeremy Moyer, co-host.
Hi.
So every week we do like to start with a big thank you to everyone that has made this show possible. And it's been wonderful. We've had about 30 guests so far. Yeah. And we are all over iTunes, Spotify. Jeremy, I don't remember how many places.
Yeah.
You can find us pretty easily. We love what we're doing here. And we're really trying to share as much knowledge as possible. And the guests that we have are fantastic. I'm very excited about today's. But Jeremy, wanted to share one thing. I have been talking about the Lehigh Valley and our GDP since the first show. And just a few years ago, we were around $36 billion in GDP. And we are now over $43 billion for the entire valley. So really great time. Please check out the articles that are out there. There's a ton of movement in our market. And it's been a lot of fun. So with that, Jeremy, please introduce our guest.
Absolutely. So I'm excited to announce our guest today. We have Gene Trowbridge with the Trowbridge Law Group. So Gene's law practice concentrates on the syndication of commercial and investment real estate through both debt and equity. Between Gene's individual syndication practice and the firm's legal practice, the partners in the firm have written offerings for more than $5 billion of money raised. The median offering size is $2.5 million. His practice writes offerings under Rule 506B, 506C of Regulation D, and then Regulation A. As a former syndicator who for 10 years raised investor capital through the broker-dealer community, he's able to communicate with his clients on both the technical and the practical aspects of state and federal securities laws. As a longtime CCIM and CCIM senior instructor, now having attained senior emeritus status, Gene won numerous awards for his teaching ability. His book, It's a Whole New Business, is really a how-to manual on real estate syndication. Gene, thanks so much for your time this afternoon and joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, guys. It's nice to be here. Sorry I didn't bring a coat and tie. You guys look pretty impressive, pretty professional. That's the MBA in you, right, Tejas?
That's right. No, very excited. And, you know, I got to read your bio beforehand. You have done, you've earned your stripes and probably seen way more than, you know, we younger folks have in no offense meant. But, I mean, you've been through a lot of different markets and cycles. It's very tremendous.
Well, thanks very much. You know, my career has had really three parts to it. I came out of college and I went into real estate and I was a commercial broker for a while. And that's where I got involved in the CCIM program and learning all that material and started teaching, which I taught for 40 years for them. And then I became a syndicator. And for about 20 years, I was putting together my own offerings, specializing in building self-storage facilities here in Southern California, where I am. Orange County, Riverside, and San Bernardino County. We did quite a bit of business, and on the last day that I counted, we had sent out 1,687 K-1s 1 year, representing about 850 investors. So that was a real, back then there were no back office companies to help you. We had to do all that yourself. And somewhere along the line, I decided I didn't want to be a syndicator anymore. So I decided I would go to law school, of all things. At 45, mm-hmm. I headed off to law school because I thought I would do that for the last 15 years of my career, because I really was anticipating retiring at 60. Well, that was 27 years ago. And actually, as we're recording this today, this is my birthday. I'm 73 years old today.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
That's all right. Going strong and just doing the legal work for syndicators. I'm really a mentor, helping people get started. I have a goal for every three repeat clients who bring a deal to me. I try to find one new client, and that's been my process over the last 10 years. And we keep building our business like that. And I'm excited. There are six of us, and we're all working virtually right now from Boston to Tennessee to San Francisco to San Diego. But we're all doing quite well. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thanks for that intro explanation, Gene. So there's a lot to get through today. In your bio and with all the different offerings types, you've mentioned the 506B and C, which is part of Regulation D, and then Regulation A. So for those that don't really understand the differences between the two, can you give high-level overview and kind of which ones are the most commonly used?
Sure. Well, Regulation D came out in 1982, and it really put into the code and the statutes what we work on today as far as private placements. And it came out, and the thing that it did the most was to generate a rule called 506. Hmm. And from really 82 to the Jobs Act in 2012, Regulation D, Rule 506, was the way that business was run. And it's just simply you couldn't advertise, but you raised money from people that you knew. You could raise as much money you wanted in every fund. You could have as many accredited investors as you wanted, and you could have up to 35 sophisticated investors. And somewhere along the line, the Congress decided that they wanted to promote capital formation. And they realized that a lot of syndicators like myself, I could only sell my offerings to people that I knew. And only people that knew me could buy my offerings. So they said, well, why don't we let, they didn't really say this, but this is a thought, why don't we let Gene go out and find as many accredited investors as he can? And why don't we let the accredited investors find as many Genes as there are out there? And maybe that'll help promote capital formation. So they came along with 506C, which we have today, which says you can advertise. It isn't just family and friends. You advertise and only take accredited investors, and you can raise as much money as you want. That's where we are. Let me give you a little background of numbers. Every year, the SEC produces some data from the research that they do. When you do a Regulation D offering, you send a form to the SEC called a Form D. Clever name, right? And it's just information gathering is what it is. And the statistics that just came out in the month of March for the previous 12 months says that 506B was responsible for $1.7 trillion of private placement money raised. And 506C was responsible for about, $100 billion. So we're talking, $1.9 trillion to $2 trillion. And that's way outpaces the amount of money that's raised on Wall Street for IPOs, for new offerings when they bring in new money. The private placement business totally is $2.7 trillion. It's just huge. That's where all the money's raised. But we do it in 506B. Most of our clients use 506B, and that's what goes on in the country. Now, I haven't talked about Regulation A yet. Up until the Jobs Act, Regulation A was kind of exciting, where you could advertise and you could take non-accredited investors. In fact, they really didn't care who you took, because you had to take your offering to the SEC and the SEC would approve all your language, all the things that you said, and give you a permit. But it was only a $5 million raise. So no one did that. I think in 2011 or 2012, there were like seven Regulation A offerings in the United States. Well, the Jobs Act came along and said, let's change this, because the limit in Regulation A was just $5 million. So they came out with two levels. They came out with the Regulation A that was $20 million, and then Regulation A plus, $50 million. $50 million, wide open advertising, no worry about accredited investors. If any of you or your listeners are familiar with Grant Cardone, Grant Cardone came out with a couple of Reg A plus offerings that our firm wrote for him. And he's standing on a stage last February. He was standing on a stage in Vegas pitching his deal to 12,000 people. Which you can do with a Regulation A. And we have clients right now who are writing a Regulation A offering, and their market is the 80,000 subscribers they have to their YouTube channel. So you have to have a big marketplace for right. that to work. And it's extremely expensive, extremely time consuming. And recently Congress just extended the Reg A Plus to $75 million a year. So it's not for everyone. But basically, what all your listeners are going to do is they're going to do a Reg D offering in either 506B or 506C. That's where all the money, that's where all the small businesses in this country raise money to get going. They go to the bank and get as much as they can, and then they go to private equity and raise their money.
It's tremendous. I don't think I've ever heard it explained concise before and eloquent.
Seriously.
Yeah, very nice.
Gene.
That means there's plenty of business.
Sure.
There's plenty of business for me to do, right? And Jonathan, my law partner, and I, we're just busy as heck, and we've got staff that help us do the typing and do our marketing. We're big on social media and everything, and it's exciting for a guy who should have retired 13 years ago. Boy, I'm as busy as I can be, even today. What am I doing today on my birthday? I'm with you guys. Why aren't I taking
it? We love it.
Well, I'm thrilled.
Well, let me ask something. So you've seen the whole industry kind of explode, I guess, over the past few years. Did that incline take place, in the 90s, recently, or when did it start really elevating?
Well, until there was Reg D and the requirement of a Form D filing, I don't think the SEC printed or published or knew of data. I don't think they knew. So it is it has been growing, certainly. You know, we had this crash in 2008, and I've been in the business. I've been writing offerings and being a syndicator myself during ups and downs of the market, you know, the 87 crash, the 93 crash, the 2008 crash. There's always syndication because there's always people who want to buy properties. Sometimes there's people who want to buy properties like today because there's plenty of money out there and there's nothing else that they really want to invest in. Although, truthfully, if you haven't been in the stock market for the past couple of years with at least some of your money, you probably missed part of the boat, you know. But real estate is very strong. And then when the market is bad and real estate professionals see blood on the street for foreclosures and everything, gosh, everyone and their brother comes out of the woodwork with money. So I used to think it was a cyclical business. I used to think it was cyclical dealing with financing. If the banks are giving you, you know, 100%, how many investors do you need? How much equity do you need? But all of a sudden the banks are only giving you 60% loans. And if everyone has 20% down, you're going to need a couple people to put that deal together. So I think it's more cyclical to financing than anything else. The availability of money and the need for equity is kind of moves our business up and down. But the last 3 years that I really know about, that the SEC has published this stuff, we're right in the 1.6, 1.7, 1.8 trillion dollar level for 506B and 506C.
Interesting. Wow. So, Gene, I want to talk about process as an operator, you know, and just kind of from the beginning to the later on. So let's say we're looking at a 50-unit apartment building or a couple hundred unit self-storage property. We're thinking about, you know, we walk the property, we like it. We're thinking about submitting an LOI shortly. You know, at what point should we, as the operator, reach out to an SEC attorney such as yourself to begin setting up the offering?
All right. Well, first of all, I take an awful lot of what I call homework calls. Before you go out and start walking properties, you're probably going to be in a position that you know, and this is where all syndicators start, you know, if you find something, you don't have enough money to buy it yourself. Mm-hmm. And so then you're going to make a decision. Well, then I better buy smaller properties that I can buy just by myself because I don't want to mess with partners. Or I need to learn about this deal of group investing. So I get a lot of homework calls and they ask me exactly that same question. When do I need to hire you, Gene? And our firm has a special clause in our fee agreements that really facilitates you or the client hiring us at the stage of the LOI. Let's get us involved right away so we can discuss. I have something called a deal structure interview that I go through with you, and we can talk about how are we going to do this deal, what are we going to do, and put it together right when the LOI is written. Now you're off to doing negotiation for the finalization of the purchase and sale agreement, and I'm already starting to formulate the private placement memorandum, which tells the story of what's happening. And the reason we like to get people started at LOI, or we can convince them to do it, is we put a clause in our fee agreement that you're going to pay us, we're going to start the work, and if this deal falls apart, we've already been paid. You know, we'll do your next deal. Hmm. Find a different property, we'll pick up where we left off, and you don't risk anything. I mean, the risk is you don't find another deal. Well, that's the way that goes. But not every law firm has that policy. And when I started the practice of law back in 95, I started with that policy because I wanted people to get started early, because it's going to take us 2 or 3 weeks, guys, to get mm-hmm. the paperwork done. And at that time, you're doing your due diligence, you're talking to the lender, and all of a sudden, you're looking at, you know, 45 days to close. Well, you better have your paperwork done. So that's really where I think people start. And many, many people even won't won't take me up on that. They'll wait till the purchase and sale agreement is fully executed, and then we'll get started. That just makes the time frame a little tighter. We lose probably a week or 10 days on that. Does that answer your question?
It did. I just had one other follow-up. You actually answered a few follow-up questions and explanations, so thank you. The operator is kind of getting soft feelers from people that he already has relationships with. Can they engage that at that point?
Deals? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
All the people that in your, and I use the analogy of a database, okay? You've got all these people in your database, okay? And if you're into a 506B, you can't advertise. And I'm going to say that what that means is putting new people into your database. Well, when is that a problem? And when you sign the fee agreement with the attorney to do a syndication, you're contemplating doing a deal, okay? Mm-hmm. And the rule is no offer or sale can be made through marketing or advertising when you have a deal or you're contemplating a deal. So my analogy is on the day that you sign the fee agreement with the attorney, your Rolodex stops. Everyone who's in your Rolodex up to that date, you have a pre-existing relationship with. Mm-hmm. So talk to them about your deal. There's nothing wrong with adding people to your Rolodex. They just can't invest in this deal that is current or contemplating. Because if they do, then you blow your exemption of having an offering that's not, that doesn't allow advertising.
Okay. And then talking about some of the specifics of what you just said, let's say during, you go to some meetup groups or when you can network in person, or you're talking about your deal, only the people that are already in your network, right, would invest in it. But
if you're going to be aggressive, mm-hmm. I think you can talk about your deal.
Gotcha.
I just don't think you can take anyone into the deal,
right,
that you didn't have a pre-existing substantive relationship. That's really what the SEC has said. And if you were sued, let's say the SEC came after you and said, you know, you advertised. The deal went bad. Someone called us and said, we didn't know these guys. They sent us a postcard. We got in their deal. Your defense would have to be, oh, no, I had a pre-existing substantive relationship with that person. And I could send them a postcard and take their money, but you'd have to prove that. So, you know, being really aggressive, you could stand up and tell the world about what your deal is. And you could talk to people about joining your database for a future deal. I don't like people doing that because mm-hmm. sponsors, you know, when they're in the midst of raising money, they get a little excited mm-hmm. and someone walks up to you that you don't know and says, you know, I've got $200,000. I'm just looking for a deal. Well, I'm not sure everyone's going to turn them down. So you have to be a little careful about that.
Let me jump in. So how many folks have actually been, you know, audited or
it's difficult. If the deal, you know, one of the exemptions that we never talk about, no one who you've ever had has talked about this exemption. It's called the good deal exemption. Okay. So if it's a good deal, no one's going to bitch. Okay. The problem is what happens if it's a bad deal? The other exemption is it's under the radar. It's an under the radar deal. It's so small that even if things go bad, the investor can call to the SEC and the police and all that. They're just not going to pay attention. So it doesn't really go anywhere unless they hire an attorney. And generally the retainer the attorney wants is more than the damages. Because all you're ever going to do at the most is get your money back. And if the deal's gone bad, you're not going to get your money back anyhow. So what are you going to do?
Thanks for that.
The real litigation and the real enforcement at the SEC is fraud. Not necessarily advertising, but fraud. And you've heard all about it. You know, Bernie Madoff, you know, he raised money from one investor to pay off another investor and told this investor that he was doing really great. But it was all new money and that's fraud. And there are people out there who do that today, and I'm going to get on the pulpit right now. There are people who either raise money from new investors as they're going along and use that money to make distributions on their 6% preferred return, or they have money in the bank that they raised ahead of time. The property isn't earning anything, but they're taking those reserves and sending the investors the check. Every investor likes to get a check, so every sponsor wants to be able to send the investor a check. But when you send the investor their money back, their own money or new money from another investor, that very potentially is fraud. Very potentially is fraud. And that's where all the major cases come from. The regulators are after people for fraudulently saying, I'm raising your money, I'm investing in this. And it doesn't happen. And I see it all the time. There are gurus out there who stand on the podium and tell people, we'll raise an extra $100,000 in your deal and use that to make distributions. So don't do that. My best legal advice.
Yeah. Yeah. Sniff test.
I had a guy call me not too long ago who's invested in a deal. I don't know anything about the deal, but he said, he heard me on some podcast. I went back and I looked at the financial statements from this deal I've invested in. And it's never made enough money to pay out the 6% return. Yet I've been getting a 6% check for the last 3 years. Where's that money coming from? I don't know. I said, you're calling the wrong person. Call the sponsor and ask them where the money's coming from.
So going back to, it seems like you should have good documentation meeting new investors, right? So just kind of circling back to that, what do you advise clients? Like, you need to at least wait a grace period of 3 months, have so many conversations, meet them in person, have this all documented in a database. Like, what does that look like? What do you advise?
Who am I advising, the passive investors or the sponsor?
Either or.
Okay, well, first of all, I think that, and this is coming more and more clear to me all the time, I think that the passive investors have an obligation to learn about the asset class in which they plan to invest. Okay, because for the most part, we're looking for sophisticated investors. Okay, so a sophisticated investor has enough knowledge to understand the offering and understand if the risk is suitable for them and blah, 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 blah. Well, if you're investing in a 50-unit apartment building, or the last Reg A deal we did, which was racehorses, is there a different level of sophistication in both of those offerings? Sure there are. Or if you're going to invest in self-storage,
right?
What do you know about self-storage? The sponsor is not going to teach you the self-storage industry. The sponsor will teach you about their offering, and that's fine. That's all they need to do. So I think there's some responsibility on the investor. And like you gentlemen, there's all sorts of great places you can go and you can listen and you can learn about asset classes. And I think the passive investor has a responsibility to protect themselves. Now, for the sponsor, I think the sponsor, this word substantive is important. The SEC has kind of defined that as a substantive relation is where the sponsor knows enough about the investor to know if they're accredited or if they're sophisticated, and is their training, their education, their life brought them to a point where they can understand the offering. Okay, so you mentioned 3 months, Jeremy. I don't think 3 months is the issue. I think you just need to know. You need to interview. And then I think that the other side of it is, does the investor know enough about the sponsor? Because I think that communication has to go both ways. The sponsor needs to learn about the investor. The investor needs to learn about the sponsor. Track record. Read the document. So I don't think that can be done in a day. Maybe it can. There's no rule that it can't be. But if things go wrong and you're asked to defend yourself, you need to show how your relationship with that investor was substantive.
That makes sense.
How many, all across the country, you work with anybody in any market? And
Federal law. Federal law. And the reason it's federal law is we have people, the properties in one state and investors in the other state. So if anything went wrong, where would you go to court? You have to go to federal court. So Regulation D is federal law. And really, we didn't talk about what is Regulation D. Regulation D says there's a whole bunch of people out there that don't need the protection of the SEC to look at all the documents, to see if everything that's written in a document is correct. And generally, Regulation D was written for the accredited investors. Accredited investors, by virtue of their wealth and their knowledge and whatever, should be smart enough to take care of themselves and ask the right questions. And the government has got so much to do to protect the other people from fraud that they're going to let the accredited investors go on their own. In 83, see, up to 83, there was always, if you're an accredited investor, fine. That's all you could do. But in 83, they said, well, maybe we should let some non-accredited investors invest. And we're going to limit the risk to 35 sophisticated investors. That's all we're going to let in a deal. So if you lose the money, there's only 35 of those people who aren't rich and smart who lose. Okay. So that's what it's all about.
I'm just pulling up a definition for the listeners, but the simple definition is high net worth individuals that know what they're doing with their money.
Well, you know, high net, just they don't even have to be smart. They don't have to be sophisticated. They just have to have, you know, the $1 million or the 200 or 300 or whatever. There are a lot of rules on accredited investors, but that basically what we're talking about is the government wants to protect people, but only has so much time, manpower, and money. So they've decided that rich people can take care of themselves.
I like that. So what kind of deals do you see?
Yeah, our firm has, we have a preponderance of multifamily deals. Stabilized and value add. We're starting to see a few new construction deals come through in the multifamily area. And then growing is the mobile home park world, because mobile home parks can be purchased and produce a little higher cash flow. And then storage facilities, just because of my background, I've always done a lot of business in storage facilities. I mean, if you're a multifamily property manager, and I came to you and said, yeah, I can give you a 600-unit property with one bathroom and no one sleeps there and no one lives there. How'd you like to manage that? And actually, we'll put a little unit there and we'll put a full-time couple in there to manage it. And it's all computerized. How does that look to you? Yeah. So people who are tired of the multifamily management moving toward towards storage, and there's a big market in storage. What drives people to mobile home parks is really the cash flow. But that's in real estate. We did a distillery not too long ago. We're doing a lot of lending. People are putting together funds where they're raising money from people, and then they're going out and making loans, or they're buying bad paper. Because there is a market for investors who just want to get interest. They don't want to be involved in investing in operations of properties, specifically, you know, the IRA market. So there's a lot of crazy things. Right now, we're working on an olive farm, I guess it's called an olive farm up in Northern California. And then we did a syndication for a group of people who were going to open a chain of hair salons on a franchise basis. So that, you know, you raise money, people need equity. And all the syndication stuff is just a set of rules on how people can raise equity.
Jeremy, I got one more and then you can take it. So Gene, I made the mistake of going to law school and never wanting to practice. And it was very calculated, but I think I have a commercial real estate team. I've been doing this for a long time, built some hotels, and it really helped to go to law school and never want to be a lawyer. But did you intend on becoming an attorney, or just, you know, using it as a way to, you know, slay real estate?
Well, I think you'll understand what I'm going to say kind of at the end of this. No, I went to law school so I could be a securities attorney. I wanted to build on my knowledge of the securities industry and private placements without the headache. You know, I mean, when I left and stopped raising money, I was managing about 900 investors, which is a headache. So that's fine. But I'll tell you what law school, and you tell me if you agree. Law school taught me, and I was a little older, 45, that there's generally at least two sides to every issue. And the divorce attorneys I know, their joke is there's his side, there's her side, and there's the truth. But in our world, it has taught me to see, I'm much more open-minded than I used to be. I have my own beliefs and everything, but I'm much more open-minded. And combine that with the 40 years I spent on the podium teaching commercial brokers how to be successful, that taught me patience. So the combination of the patience I achieved through teaching and the way I can look at issues, both sides, really made me a better person. I know that sounds hokey, but it really did.
I agree, and I'll add a little bit. I think the biggest thing I learned is like how not to ruin your life. Like, you know, constitutional law and, you know, bankruptcy and, you know, doing moot court and all these other things. It was always, you're right about, you know, there's two sides, but, you know, somebody loses or somebody makes a mistake. And my favorite thing was learning about tax law, and, you know, the tax law just kept changing because people kept figuring out more shady things to do to some degree. But yeah, I do think it's a big advantage in real estate. And, you know, looking back, I'm really happy I went. I'm not happy with how many sleepless nights and anxiety I had. But
yeah, that's really something. Well, yeah. No, I'm happy I went, and I went for the purpose. And you know, at my age, it wasn't a guarantee that I was going to be successful in law school and pass the California bar the first time. That wasn't a guarantee, but I certainly worked hard to do it. And one of the things I think I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to help you and my clients do this stuff, but do it legally and stay out of trouble.
Fair.
That's what I think I'm supposed to do. And knock on wood, we've been pretty darn good about that. I had one client who, you know, stole some money and did some stuff. Well, I can't help that. But other than that, in all the offerings I've done over the years, there's just one person I know who's ever got in legal trouble. I mean, there's people whose deals went bad, hurricanes hit properties and destroyed properties, and there's investors who are mad. But as far as legal trouble, there's only been one, and he was stupid. Okay, stupid and a crook, and went to jail.
Yeah, love the bluntness.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gene, we really do appreciate your time. So in closing, can you let our listeners just know more about how to, you know, get in touch with you, or if they have any questions, just follow up on that one-on-one basis?
Yes, let's just leave it at emails. My email is gene@trowbridgelawgroup.com, and that's also our website. So if you wanted to go to trowbridgelawgroup.com, you could sign up for a half-hour consultation that's free. Or if you don't want to go through that, just send me an email and say you want to talk to me. I use emails pretty much as an introduction to get on the telephone with you. So if you want to talk to me, it doesn't do any good if you don't give me your phone number. Because now I have to send you an email and say, yeah, give me a call or I'll call you. So I want to talk to you, Gene. Here's my phone number and I'll respond. And that would be great.
I got one more thing in closing.
Oh, no, there it is.
There it is. And I got your name in it. That's why my eyes were wiggling halfway through the podcast.
That's awesome.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. There's been a lot of them, you know, but everyone's special.
No, you've been tremendous. We really appreciate it. And I can say we definitely would like to have you back on maybe in a couple months just to touch base.
Yeah, I've got some things we'll talk about. I've got some things that in a planned presentation with you with a lot of questions might be interesting and educational for your listeners. I'd love to come back. Thank you.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. This is Real Estate Investor MBA. Check us out online. We're all over the internet. And luckily, Jeremy is the one who books the guests. So clearly, he's doing a fantastic job. And Gene, thank you again so much. We'll check you guys next time.
You're welcome. Bye, guys.
Bye.